Welcome to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, Episode 6. Today on the show, I have Nick Garcia, strength and throws coach at Notre Dame High School, Sherman Oaks, California. This episode is brought to you by Train Heroic. Train Heroic is an athlete management platform that allows coaches to create and distribute cloud-based workouts on mobile devices. For me, in my own experience, I was at this point in my online programming on Just Fly Sports, where I needed a more advanced database of workouts, exercises, and associated videos to help me better serve those I work with online. I selected Train Heroic to use with my online clients for two reasons. One was that the platform is easy to both learn and use. The entire week's workouts, Sunday through Saturday, is listed across your dashboard or your home screen. Secondly, the program is affordable. It hasn't made a big dent in my balance sheet, and I really appreciate that. So if you're a coach interested in the Train Heroic platform, and I would definitely recommend it if you're looking at a more advanced way of creating workouts and managing them amongst your athletes, they are offering a 14-day free trial of the product at trainheroic.com. All right, welcome to the show. Today's guest is Nick Garcia, strength and throws coach at Notre Dame High School in Sherman Oaks, California. Nick has had a ridiculous track record in coaching specifically shot put in Notre Dame. He's coached over 35 guys to the 50-foot marker beyond, and which is an unprecedented coaching ability and consistency. And I first met Nick a little bit over a year ago at a Hammer Media seminar and was really impressed with, and that also being the first time I had really truly heard the Bondarchuk system explained, and was really impressed with Nick's knowledge of it, as well as his knowledge of the traditional system and block periodization, and how and when to use either system, the ins and outs of both, as well as what we can learn one system to the other. And there are a lot of implications. So whether you're a track coach or not, if you're a strength coach, or just looking to learn a little bit more about how the body adapts to training, Nick is a great guy to talk to. So I'm excited to have him on the show today. One last thing before we start the show. And if you're not familiar with the Bondarchuk training system, I left a couple links within the show notes in the associated article on Just Fly Sports. So be sure to check that out if you're not familiar with the Bondarchuk system, as Nick is going to reference it quite often. And the more you know about the system, the more that you are going to get out of this particular podcast. All right, welcome to the show. And Nick, it's great to have you on today, man.
Well, like I said, it's my privilege to be here. I can talk shop all day long, and like I said, it's my honor to be on a podcast. I always look forward to this stuff, and I'm fired up about it.
Awesome. And the question that I think I'd like to lead off with, you have great experience with the Bondarchuk training method, the philosophy of which is really permeating the strength and conditioning community, and obviously the track and field community, and rightly so. And I wanted to ask you, how has the way you've coached athletes changed since you've encountered Bondarchuk's training method, whether that be using the Bondarchuk method or just you, within the scope of traditional training methods?
Well, one thing that I'd like to start off with is that people say they use forms of the Bondarchuk method, and in my opinion, either you use it or you don't use it. And there's a specific way it's set up, and there's a specific thing you're looking for when you use his method, and that specific thing you're looking for is the athlete's adaptation pattern. And if you continually do different things with in a traditional sense that people often do, then you're not going to get the adaptation pattern you're looking for. So yes, people use different parts of a Bondarchuk's philosophy, I guess, which is usually specific strength type movements, but they're not using the actual system. They're just using specific strength, which in general everybody uses specific strength for at some point, but he has made it popular with the way he classifies his exercises. But to answer your question, the way I've changed my training philosophies is, since I coach high school athletes, a lot of them do both, you know, football track or basketball track and whatnot. So those type of kids I can't use the system with because I won't have enough time to develop their pattern. And they're doing different things all the time. So the more things you throw into the workout or the training plan, the more it changes the adaptation. If it's different every time, you're not going to get the right pattern every time. So the way I've used more of the specific strength element that Dr. B has inside his training program, and we'll add in more specific development exercises than I normally have when I use a traditional system. So, for example, we'll do our training, and then we'll do specific development exercises, and then we'll go in the weight room and hit our weight room. Another thing is that part of the Dr. B system is at the very end, the GPEs, general preparation exercises, he'll use an ab exercise, a back exercise, and a twisty exercise. And what I've done from that, I've created core circuits now that we use where no matter what day it is, no matter what we're doing, we always train three planes of movement. So we're always going to do a twisting exercise, we're always going to do a frontal plane movement, and we're always going to do an ab exercise in our training. So that's how I've applied it to athletes who use a traditional system. Now, for example, I have some athletes coming in that have are coming to my high school next year that I know about, and they're track athletes only. So right away when I know they're track athletes, then we're going to start off using the Dr. B system. I'm rambling on a little bit here, but a lot of people are kind of against the fact that, well, these athletes coming in don't really have a base of strength, so the Dr. B system might not work. Well, in the past number of years, I've had some good throwers that had no base of strength, and we've used only the Dr. B system, and we have great results. So it's on how you look at it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, too, and this is maybe the next question I can kind of lead into with that, is I think I remember you talking about this before, that the way that strength training is delivered in the Dr. B system can actually be, in a lot of cases, just as good as traditional training, just because the total volume. And so do you mind talking a little bit about the effects of strength gain in using Dr. B system in some of these athletes versus maybe a traditional training?
Well, the way I say versus traditional, the way I compare it is, basically, we train at 60 to 70% every day. Like, we find our weights now using velocity-based training, which I know we're going to touch on later. But, for example, if we train at 60% of your max, and we're being conservative there, of your squat max, and we do that 2 days on, 1 day off, 2 days on, 1 day off, 2 days on, 1 day off, you're getting roughly 5 squat sessions in a week, right? If you take that up and you say, okay, we're going to do that squat session, 3 sets of 5 at 70% every single day of training, which is 5 days, and you add that tonnage up and that volume up, it far surpasses the traditional way of squatting heavy on a Monday and coming back on a Thursday and squatting medium. It's like almost double. Like, I don't have the calculations in front of me right now, but it's almost double. So you're not only getting your tonnage in, you're getting your volume in, and at the same time, you're not destroying your nervous system with that one heavy day where you can't come back and do good technical work that the following day. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're able to do this train every day at 70%, without destroying your nervous system, and which enhances your technical work. You have that one heavy squat day, or clean day, or whatever, and you come back out the next day, and you're pretty shot from that workout. And so you may not get a lot of good technical work in. I'm not saying you can't get it done, but I'm saying it's a little bit tougher.
Yeah. How do you, when you do your traditional programming, Nick, how do you kind of manage the nervous system, with your traditional performance weeks and volume weeks and building weeks and those types of things?
Well, the way I manage it is we have, and this is, I've derived from it, the genesis was from an old Olympic lifting program that I've tweaked and made my own, basically. And I got along way back in 2003 when I was a youngster. And I always held on to it, so I'm going to use this one day. And it's a 13-week cycle, and I line it up with the track season. And the way it works is we have three 4-week cycles. And those 3 4-week cycles each have a theme. The first 4-week cycle is volume. The second 4-week cycle is strength development. And the third 4-week cycle is neural training, or performance training, they call it. Within those weeks of each cycle, you have a base week, a volume week, an unload week, and a performance week. And obviously, all the percentages and intensities move up and down throughout that cycle. And the simple part about it is the first 4 weeks you're at 5s on the power lifts and 3s on the Olympic lifts. The next 4 weeks of the next cycle you're at 3s on the power lifts and 2s on the Olympic lifts. And the final ones you're at doubles on the power lifts and singles on the Olympic lifts. And that's basically how it works. As far as you adjust the intensities, what people forget and what I didn't understand at the beginning is that, yeah, we have our base week, then we have a big volume week, which you get beat up from. Then you have your unload week. Well, usually, you unload and you're thinking, okay, well, I'm going to have good performances this week, especially in track. Well, the reality is that it takes about a week and a half to 2 weeks for you to feel that unload. So that unload won't really – your performance won't really improve till the actual performance week. And you see a little bit of a lag time. So we also have a 13th week to that program, and that 13th week is called prep. And that prep week is also an unload week, so it'll go – the final 5 weeks will go base week, volume week, unload week, performance week. Then we'll do a prep week, which is like an unload week. And then we'll have we'll continue that kind of cycle of prepping. We'll change the sets and reps a little bit and the intensity through the next 4 weeks. But you won't see your big performance until about 2 weeks after you hit that prep week. So it's been dead on every single time I've done it for the past 5 years. All my kids that use a traditional system, will improve a meter or more after we unload. But you have to be patient in the fact that it's going to take – you have that lag time. You have to understand you have that lag time. So depending on what athlete you use it on, you have to start them at different points of the season. Like if this kid's only good enough to make the league meet, you have to prep them for the league meet. If this kid's only good enough to make the Masters meet, then you have to prep them to throw that PR there. So it just it depends. It takes a lot of planning. But that 13-week plan with a little lag time, it works every time.
Interesting. This is kind of a little bit of a random question, but you're talking about the lag time to performance, a little bit of a delayed transformation, I guess, maybe in the technical term. But, and obviously Dr. B's system, and then for those of you listening, and Nick, please correct me if I'm wrong, you'll track the throw every single day throughout the cycle, and you typically will see, many people will see a decline, like middle of the way through the cycle, and then you'll be on the way up towards the end of it. How do you notice the curves kind of shake out in traditional programming? I mean, I guess it's a different animal, but do you notice the same like dip and then transformation at the end or any sort of different pattern between the two? I guess it's two different worlds.
It is two different worlds. And I'm going to ask the question exactly how you asked it, but I want to add something to it. Is a few weeks ago, Kenway Johnson, who uses the Dr. B system, obviously he had on there, somebody had posted, are you at your peak in performance when you're at your peak at lifting? And there was a little argument about it. And I'd say in a traditional system, no, you are not. But in Dr. B's system, yes, you are. So when we train with Dr. B's system, often now is I use a push device or a tendo, and we track the speeds of our bar. And it was as far as we track our throws every day. And when our speeds are up, our throws are way up. And when our speeds are down, our throws are down. So when you're training in that sense, our lifting speeds are up, our throws are up at the same time. Now, like I said, in my traditional program, we have that little lag time where it's about when you're at your peak strength levels, it's about 2 weeks, a week and a half to 2 weeks before you hit that big throw or they hit their big throws. They're both two different worlds, like you said. Now, what I have found is that the kids will pretty much – I explained to them we have to fight to stay at the level we're at when we're using that traditional system. So what I'll find is we stay pretty stagnant, between a foot or two. And then once we hit that unload, that's when we have the big upward swing, I guess you would want to call it. Dr. B's training, yes, we'll have – There's three different styles of athletes. There's one who will start out stagnant, drop off, and then go up. There's one who just keeps going up. There's one who will stay stagnant and then go up at the end. There's three different styles. So which you can see in his books and his research. But what I found is using the traditional system, we'll stay pretty much stagnant unless we're on a volume week. We'll have a little bit of a drop off. And then once we unload and hit that 2 week lag time, we'll hit our big throws. So it's pretty level across the board until we hit that unload.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. And I think that it kind of says a lot, and maybe this is an area too where just the philosophy of the Bondarchuk system and the way that I almost would call his approach to strength training very similar to like some Dan, John, Pavel, easy strength type stuff, where it just rides along and rides right in the motor pattern of what you're doing with the throws, where traditionally you're kind of seeking the hormonal overshoot and you're planning it that way. but that's really interesting to me. I've heard different throwers say different things about, I'm going to hit max weights here and then I'm going to have to kind of wait a particular amount of time after that to be at my best. So it's really interesting the differences between specific oriented training system and where you're at versus using the weights and the overload.
Yeah, Vestine, I was at the Canadian Throat Seminar a few years ago, and Vestine Hefstijsen presented, and he's Gert Kanter's coach, and Joachim Olsen's coach, who are both Olympic medalists. One was a gold medalist. And he explained how both of them he used the same system with, but like it would take a little bit longer for the transfer of strength into the power for Joachim Olsen versus Gert Kanter. One took maybe 9 weeks and one took 6 weeks. So he took that into account, the fact that he's got to unload this guy 9 weeks ahead of time and unload this guy 6 weeks ahead of time in order to get the big throws.
Interesting. Do you find that different types of athletes tend to be in a certain, you know, like an athlete with a higher max strength potential versus a more explosive athlete, or is it just kind of just very individual and hard to decipher?
For me, it's very individual and hard to decipher. But what I'll do is, when I'm using a traditional system, if I have a kid who's not very explosive, my objective is just to get him as strong as possible, and let that, because that's what he has, right? I mean, he doesn't have that fast switch if he's not very explosive. We're going to work on that stuff, but we're just going to get him as strong as possible, and hopefully that carries over. So it just, you know, depends. It depends how I approach things based on if you're explosive or if you're not explosive.
Sure.
My kid this year, he's a 62-11 and 3/4 shot putter. He's a junior, and I'm really fighting right now with what I'm going to do with him next year, because he's going to be done playing football, and yeah, he's going to continue his football career in college, but I'm going to have him just do track from December on. So I would personally, and he's strong as a house, so his strength levels are high enough where, okay, I could adjust and go to straight Dr. B system and really work that specific strength with different way to implement, and then the speed in the weight room. But I could also use the system I've been using, which was worked very well. So it's a big debate. But I think I'm leaning more towards going the Dr. B way and seeing how that works out.
Sure. So would you say for the majority of your throwers, you would go the Dr. B route? And I mean, is there any throwers that you, and this is a misplaced question, is there any throwers that you tend to train traditionally, or is the traditional system just saved more for your team sport athletes?
The traditional system is more for my team sport athletes. Now, these day and age, like our, especially American kids, they have to feel strong, and they have to feel like they're moving big weight, and they have to feel as strong as the other kids. So I have a kid right now who I want to use a Dr. B system with, and he's just not really buying into it, so it's not going to benefit us to use it if he's not going to buy into it. I always use this one kid, Kyle Swanson. He was the kid I was telling you about. He had a very, very low base of strength, very low athleticism level from when I got him his freshman year. He threw 34 feet 6 inches with a 10-pound shot his freshman year. His sophomore year, we moved him to a straight Dr. B system, and we lifted at – we found his maxes around, and you know, he lifted at 60-70% his whole next 3 years, and he went from – 34 feet his freshman year to 46 his sophomore year with a 10. And then from his sophomore year to junior, he had a huge jump to 53-10 with a 12-pound shot. And then his senior year, he threw over 56 feet. And he never cleaned over 80 kilos. He never squatted over 220 or 100 kilos, 225 pounds. He didn't bench one time. And a lot of kids think that, and a lot of coaches think that bench is the most important lift for the shot, when I did my graduate thesis a few years back, and he didn't bench one time. All we did were specific development exercises for pressing, and it kind of just goes to show you right there that using specific strength, using multiple weighted implements, and doing different types of pressing exercises that relate to the shot shows that you don't need to bench press, number one. And number two, velocity based training, basically that's what kind of Dr. B stuff is has more transfer. And Brian Mann, who a lot of people are familiar with, he tells a story, or told a story on our podcast, where he did his research study on basketball and how the vertical jump is associated with the power clean. And he thought the power clean would have huge carryover to the vertical jump. Well, the power clean he was doing, they were doing it and they were getting in the bar up no matter what. So if they move the bar at 0.5 meters per second, they still got it up as a clean, then it would count. And what he found when he got his research back, it had zero carryover to the vertical jump. And because of that, he thought, well, I either need to change the way we're training to clean, or we need to take it out. So he changed the way they were doing it, and he started doing it with velocity-based stuff, saying, okay, you need to move the bar at this fast and at this speed for it to count. did it that way. And what he found was behind body composition and squat, it had the third best carryover. And you could kind of throw body comp out because, you know, everybody's different weight and size. But that carryover being third showed that you don't need to clean heavy in order to have transfer. You need to clean correctly and explosively. Train fast to be fast.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a story that's always kind of near to me in my own training. When I was in college, I was one of those high school kids who read all the bigger, faster, stronger magazines, and you heard those stories of the Soviet high jumper or the Soviet Olympic lifters who would clean and jerk 500 pounds at 200, and they could high jump 7 feet off 3 steps and all this, and so I was convinced that hitting some magic clean number was gonna help me high jump 7.4 or something, and I found really quickly that I got my clean up a lot. I probably put 60 pounds off what I did in high school almost, and didn't jump any higher, and most meets jumped worse. And my junior year, I started to understand the purpose or the point of being a little bit more balanced. And I think I only cleaned the year before, I cleaned 240 as a sophomore. I only cleaned 200 as a junior, and I didn't even care that much about it, and just worked lightweights and was a lot more balanced with my speed and bringing up, like, my squat was lagging a little bit and a few other things, and I jumped 7 feet and blew away my triple jump PR. And then I was like, oh, I guess maybe this isn't that important after all, or at least just going for a max.
Yeah, absolutely. And like that kid Kyle Swanson, I know he made the Masters meet, and which is a really tough thing to do here in Southern California. And I know for a fact there were kids that were 10, 15 times stronger than he was. But he was out there mixing up with him because he had trained a specific way and he believed in it, and that's why it worked. So don't get me wrong. I use a traditional system as well, but if I have a choice, I'm going to use the Dr. B system because it's obviously proven to be very well, both from what I've applied it and what he's done with his career as a coach.
Yeah, absolutely. It's got to be really really nice to work with those kids who don't have mental anchors wrapped around particular barbell weights too. Like, could just totally buy into the Dr. B system, and you can really just see how powerful it can be. And you know, those are always great situations. I did want to ask. Yeah, you mentioned a little bit, Nick, about velocity based training, and that was one of the questions I wanted to ask you. And you know, I've heard a few things, and this is just more so. And I guess maybe this could be a two-headed question here. One, having to do with how it works within the Dr. B system. And that was a great Brian Mann anecdote you gave. And I had first heard that a few years ago, and it totally changed the way that I thought about using the Olympic lifts. Even though I had that experience when I was in college, sometimes you forget and need to be reminded in your coaching. What I wanted to ask how do you use and consider velocity-based training within the Dr. B system? And then also within traditional, you know, where do you feel like it fits within the traditional system? Because I've seen it both ways. I've seen coaches who love it. The majority of coaches love it. And I've even seen before there was velocity-based training, I've seen systems out of the 70s and 80s where they still emphasize bar speed, or they put a stopwatch on the bar or something. But I also see good coaches, even successful ones, who don't do it purposefully just for the reason of not over intensifying it, you know, leaving like the track to the track and the weight room for general, a true general prep exercise type mentality. So, what's your take on how you use it in the Dr. B system? And secondly, how would you use it and consider it in the traditional system?
Well, usually for the Dr. B system, what we've done is, and Derek Healy came up with this out of Canada, who was responsible for bringing Dr. B to Canada. He coached Dylan Armstrong before Dr. B, and he's coached Sophie Hitcham and Sultana Frizzell to a Canadian record and British record. He came up with a concept, and we discussed it, and it was, why don't we find our weight? Usually we train at 60-70% in the Dr. B weight. Well, speed strength is said in the squat and bench to be at 0.8 to 1.0 meters per second average. And for the clean or for the snatch, you're at 1.25 for the clean roughly from the floor and 1.4 or so in the snatch. Well, we decided, well, why don't we do this? Why don't we set our weights for the Dr. B system each cycle based on the velocity of the bar? So if we want speed strength, which is 0.8 to 1.0 for the bench or squat, we're going to set our weight at 0.7. So when we adapt to the training, we have that upward swing. we're going to be between 0.8 and 1.0 because we're going to have the adaptation and we're going to get better. So when we do adapt, the stimulus will still be there for us between 0.8 and 1.0, rather than if we set the weights at 1.0, then it would be at 1.2 or 1.3 and we'd be training for something different. So we set the bar at point, or set the speeds at 0.6 for squat and bench or whatever slower movement we're doing. We're hoping when we adapt, we'll be at, you know, 0.8 to 1.0, and basically that's how we set our weights, using it for the Dr. B system. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So just to clarify, so I guess percentages aside, you would if you're at 0.7 and hoping to adapt upwards, you would just put on a weight that you move at 0.7 that day, and it's a full effort, or are you holding back at all?
No, not holding back at all. So let's say, for example, we start our developmental cycle for the Dr. B system, and we pick our exercises. Well, that first day, what we're going to do is we're going to find out what we move at 0.7. So if I put 105 kilos on the bar and I move that at 0.9, then I'm saying, okay, well, this is a little too light, excuse me. This is a little too light, and so we need to bump it up a little more. So we're going to put 115 kilos on. Okay, we're moving at 0.7. So 115 kilos for our squat is going to be our squat day in and day out, no matter what. 115 every day for 3 sets of 5. 115 every day for 3 sets of 5, and we'll track the speeds every day. And some days the speeds will be 0.6 or 0.55 because we're tired and a little beat up from the volume. But then when we adapt, you see a big gigantic jump in the speeds, and you'll see a big gigantic jump in the throws. And instead of being at 0.6 or 0.7, we'll now be in the range of 0.8 to 1.0. Where if we didn't kind of use the velocity-based type stuff, we may – let's say we set it at 0.8 or 0.9 just without using it. It just happened to be 105 kilos that we used. During that whole time, we're using speed strength. But when we adapt, we're going to move out of that speed strength realm if we get over 1.0. So it's not going to have the same stimulus if that – does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. I got you now.
So that's how we do it. And as far as the traditional system, I use it in many different ways in a traditional system, especially for football, American football. And the reason why we use it for American football is because we train on Saturdays. And we train on Saturdays. We play on Friday night. So what their 80% max is on Saturday, generally, if they didn't play a football game Friday night, will probably be 100% if they played a football game Friday night, because they're going to be beat up. So instead of basing things off percentages, we base things off of velocity. So the new term lately is auto-regulation. It auto-regulates how heavy they're going. So they can't beat themselves anymore, because our goal is to be fast in the field, so we're going to train fast. And they're going to know that, okay, when we do a hang snatch, we got to be above 1.45 meters per second. So if they put 50 kilos on the bar and they're not at 1.45 meters per second, they know they have to drop. So in a sense, if you're a kid, it's more so idiot-proof with the fact that, okay, I got to drop weight because I'm heavy. And they get that and they understand it. Also, I use it if you have a good portal and you look at all the data from all the athletes, you can tell, well, his speeds are way down from last week and he's using a lower weight. So these kids are probably a little beat up. That's my cue to go to the head coach and say, hey, coach, our guys are a little beat up on the field. We should probably back practice off 30 minutes or an hour each day now in order to help them recover a little bit more, because they're not recovering. And the final way I use it is, especially with female athletes who are intimidated by going heavy on anything, what I'll do is at the beginning, I'll set them up with their portal, set them up with their push device, or whatever I'm using. I'll say, okay, I want you to do a one-arm snatch that needs to be moving this fast. And girls are very – at least my girls are – they're very, very detailed about those things, and they really understand them. So instead of worrying about how heavy they're going, they're worried about the number. So, well, hey, I'm not moving it fast enough if I'm going 20 pounds. I'm going to drop to 15. Or I'm moving it too fast when I'm going 20 pounds, so I'm going to jump it up to 30 to see how that works. So they're not necessarily worried about how much weight they're doing. They're worried about moving the bar the correct speed. And that's really made a difference in the program as far as how much we get done and how fast we get done, because it takes a little while for those beginning athletes to get comfortable in the weight room, to understand how fast they – or understand what weight they should be doing. Well, using velocity-based training, it makes things a little bit easier to get going in the weight room quicker.
I agree. I like what you said about the female athletes too. I had that same experience my first year working at Cal, where one of the jumps coaches and I was having that conversation about velocity-based training, specifically females, because the women just weren't as competitive and naturally oriented towards being explosive in the weight room as the men were. But as soon as you put the tendo on the bar, it was like something magic happened. I mean, they all of a sudden, it's like something went off. It was like that story you created for them by putting a number on the bar. It just totally changed the whole environment.
Exactly. You know what I've had trouble with is I've used all different ones. I haven't used Gym Aware because it's very, it's expensive. And we got a great, great facility. We have the same type of facility you guys have at Cal. We have all Sornex. But I've used the Tendo, and I've used the Bar Sensei, and I've used the Push device. We've had the most success with the Push device as far as ease of use. But the most potential, I think, lies with the Bar Sensei because it straps onto the bar and it reads on a one iPad, so you don't need to be switching bands or anything like that. It's just on the bar right there. So that's the there's positive and negative of each of the devices. But I think the most potential lies with the Bar Sensei.
Yeah, because it's cheaper. Convenient.
It's cheaper and it wraps around the bar.
Yeah. I think the less switching you have to do, the better, for sure. I guess over time, that could be a really good thing.
Exactly.
Okay, so along the idea of things that would intensify the weight room, I guess, I wanted to ask you your opinion on bands and chains. Was that something that might be seen in the Dr. B system? And I guess more importantly, how does that, if it does, play a role in your use in the traditional system?
We'll definitely use bands. We'll use bottom bands. We'll use top bands. We'll use chains. Now, I kind of stay away from chains squatting. We use them this year a little bit. But what scares me about it is that if you have a track athlete and a football athlete, well, the best time to use chains for a football athlete is kind of during track season because you're farther away from the season. Well, you do that during track season, and like I just talked about, you train fast, you play fast. You're moving a little slower when you're using the chain. So we don't use them as much as far as squatting goes, but we'll use them more for the upper body. And that's just my philosophy and how I see things and how I see training works. Dr. B system, like I talked about a little earlier with you, is we do specific development exercises, and I had a Sornex make me a shot put ball to attach to a jammer arm on our racks, and that jammer arm, you could attach bands to it or you could attach plates to it. Well, first, it was like, well, hey, the bands will be great. It'll be a different type of movement. It'll be a different type of specific development exercise. But after thinking about it more, we want everything to accelerate, not decelerate. And the farther you stretch a band, the more the band's going to decelerate the movement. So I kind of got away from that as far as specific development exercises go. But as far as traditional movements like squat or bench, we'll definitely include those within the program, depending on what type of year, where the year is at, and whatnot. So we'll still make sure that we move the bar fairly quickly, use the velocity-based training, even though we have bands on it or even though we have chains on it. So you're still getting that stimulus that the chains are supposed to give you and the bands are supposed to give you. It's just not as slow or absolute strength-based, I guess.
Sure. I like the rationale, too, behind not wanting to load bands and chains too heavily. How much velocity would you allow for a drop off really in using when you throw the bands on or chains on?
Well, what we would do is we would still say, okay, like we talked about earlier, I want the squat moving at 0.8 meters per second. Well, I still want, 0.7 meters per second when we start a developmental cycle. Well, if we're going to use chains, I'm still going to want that bar moving at 0.7 meters per second. It just has a different feel to it since it has the chains on it.
Sure. So just a subtle difference. It's not like it's not an elephant. It's more of a mouse in the grand scheme of things, but just enough to keep it fresh type mentality.
Exactly. Absolutely. Just enough to keep it fresh and different.
Awesome. Yeah, I like that. I had heard the same thing, with your example on the shot put and how the band would cause you to slow down. I'd heard the same thing for vertical jump training some time ago. And, saying if you use too heavy of bands, all you're doing is you're teaching yourself to be slow when you should be towing off hard. And so I like your ideas on the lighter bands, and you're still punching through with the velocity-based training, and it definitely makes sense as the best way to utilize that type of stimulus.
One way, one thing that I think about it, too, is I did my thesis on on weightlifting methods of elite shot putters, and one of the questions in there was about overweight underweight training, and there was a lot of research done up on shot put specifically at that time, but there was lots of research done on swinging heavy bats before you get in the batter circle. And what the research showed was if you swing a heavier bat before you get in the batter's box, that it actually slowed your bat speed down rather than sped it up. It actually did the opposite. So that was kind of interesting. And if you kind of look at it, what you're saying with the band decelerating as it gets stretched, you know, that just kind of goes to show you that it probably does decelerate you rather than accelerating you.
Yeah. The neural patterns, if they're intense enough and in the wrong direction, they can definitely have an impact on the motor program of the athlete in their actual sport. So a question, kind of moving a slightly different direction, and this is something that I remember when you and Martin were presenting on the Dr. B system here at Cal, and it was actually the first time I'd heard the system really, really fully explained, and it was a wonderful seminar. And you were just talking a little bit, I think this might have even been after in the question and answer period, but about the length of training cycles, because the Dr. B developmental cycles, I mean, those run on average about 8 to 10 weeks, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, depending on the response, but in light of that, you were talking a little bit about how maybe we tend to run our cycles too short in traditional programming. And so what are your thoughts in that realm of things?
Well, the Dr. B scheme is, like, it can run 8 to 10 weeks. We try not to have it run that long because the more developmental cycles you could have in a season, the more development you're going to have in your sport. So a lot of the developmental cycles are based on the individual athlete. For example, myself, I take 16 to 22 sessions to hit peak performance. So after 22 sessions, I know that I'm pretty much done with that developmental cycle. I'm going to have a big drop-off. So if you look at that, it's going to be about, if you go 2 days on, 1 day off, and you manipulate things based on when your meet schedule is, that takes about 4 to 5 weeks. Now, if you're doing a two-part program, which doubles the amount of exercise you're doing, which doubles the amount of things that you're doing, it will obviously take your body a lot longer to adapt to that. So you could probably count on double that. And then there's where your 8 weeks are at, or 7 to 8 weeks of adaptation are. So it often depends on the individual. Like Martin. Martin's a lot longer than me as far as how long it takes him to adapt. And he's almost twice as long as me. And it's just the way the individual works. My personal athletes, one of my girls that go to you, that you may work with in the past, Ganika, when she was working with me, it took her junior, we had her set at 12 to 15, and I thought that was it. And she always hit peak, had a mini peak during that time. Well, after her junior year, we let a developmental cycle go extra long, and she actually hit her peak performance in the 20s. And I really screwed up her – we still did a great job her junior year, but I screwed it up because I didn't let the developmental cycle go long enough the first time, and I thought her first mini peak was her actual peak. So we had it figured out her senior year where it happened in the 20s rather than the 12s, so she had a little bit more development per cycle. Traditional-wise, I tend to keep my – depending on what system I'm using – traditional wise, we keep between four and six weeks, and sometimes I think 6 weeks is probably the max that we'll keep them. But I think, you know, sometimes you have guys doing, you know, 3 week cycles, and sometimes 3 week cycles I feel aren't long enough for the body to adapt. And people ask, well, why do you feel that CrossFit, you know, is not beneficial, or why do you feel that 3 weeks isn't long enough? Well, when you're doing CrossFit, In my opinion, and I could be completely off base here, but in my opinion as an athlete, you're training to adapt to something. And when you adapt to something, you switch it. And if you never adapt to something, you never actually get full potential out of that movement, and you don't ever get everything you can out of what you're trying to do. So if you look at a CrossFit perspective, they change things every single day. So when are you actually going to get better at what you're trying to do? Or what are you trying to do in that sense? Athletes train for a specific goal. Okay, I want to jump farther. I want to run faster. I want to throw farther, etc. Well, in order to do that, you have to have specific goals and train those specific goals for a certain amount of time for that to happen. And if you keep changing things often, you're probably not going to get full development out of that cycle. And I don't know, is that, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something I've always, that I think the Bondarchuk system has really intrigued me with, is in terms of, it's almost like the absolute contrast to the Westside type system where you run short cycles and then change things every couple weeks. And I don't know, maybe that's because the stimulus of powerlifting is so intense on all these systems that people have to. I'm not sure. Where maybe throws is a little bit more coordinative demands. But I think it's interesting where people pull their information from.
Well, I think if you take a step back and look at the powerlifting guys are only doing powerlifting, and the Olympic lifters are only doing Olympic lifting. Athletes are playing football, they're playing soccer, they're doing track and a bunch of other stuff. Like, for example, let's take a shot. We'll just take a shot putter, for example, since that's what I'm very familiar with, or a sprinter. They're going to be doing plyos. They're going to be doing med ball throws. They're going to be doing sprint work. Even if you are a thrower, you do sprint work often. Plus, they got their weightlifting routines to do. So I think that's why in our area, our environment, our world, that's why cycles aren't long enough, is because they have all that other stuff to adapt to as well. Well, while the powerlifters and the Olympic lifters only have their specific movements to adapt to.
Yeah, there's a lot more degrees of freedom in sport, or even throwing, compared to powerlifting. There's not a whole lot of degrees of freedom in powerlifting. I've always kind of wondered if that, you know, lack of degree of freedom type ideal just causes people that need to switch or adapt faster or something. But yeah, I've learned a lot just through considering how that system has worked with the Dr. B and all that. One thing I did want to ask you within that scope too, and I think you and Martin were talking about this on one of your recent podcasts, and that's, you know, kind of when you're in that hole, you know, in the developmental cycle, and you're I don't know, like maybe 25 sessions in or so, and you have athletes who are in that hole, but they're ready to come back up. And do athletes struggle with being there, like, often? I know that I kind of feel like, especially like maybe people who have been through it their first time or just in the process of establishing buy-in, like, how do you mitigate that period in that longer developmental cycle?
Well, the first one is always the toughest one to do that, because you have to make sure they understand we have to go through this for a long time to make sure we find the right amount of sessions where you adapt that. Number two, after a certain amount of developmental cycles, you'll have a specific pattern. So when I go back, I'll bring my athletes in and I'll say, hey, check this out. I say, yeah, you're down right here, but you come up all the time at this point. And what you're saying is actually has a reverse effect, because they'll have confidence in the fact that when we get to session 15, I'm going to be money. I'm going to be jacked and I'm going to be ready to rock. And they know they're going to be down for a period, but they also see that graph, say, well, I'm getting to this point. Every time it's been right, every time it's been dead on within a session or two. So I know that I'm going to come out of this, I'm going to be better than I was before. So psychologically, the data feedback and the graphs are what really helped me in that sense. But that's a great question.
Yeah, to me, I'm just amazed by, I guess, the accuracy of the human adaptation ability, that, you know, that it is a particular amount of sessions. But it makes sense to me. Do you find do people's you know, age or gain training experience or whatnot, does their time to adaptation change over a period of years? Like, would you, if you were 20, would you adapt differently, or time to adaptation at like 27 or 28?
You know, mine hasn't changed too much in the past 6 years, 5 or 6 years. But then again, like, I wasn't on the same system when I was, you know, 20 years old or 25 years old, so. I'd be lying to you if I told you the truth, if I had experience with that. But I think that with my conversation with Martin, is that things change a little bit as they get older, and it gets tougher as you get older. One thing that I know for sure is true is that most of the younger athletes have their peak performances during developmental cycles at the very end. It's called a period of PDS, sport form, peak development sport form. They have it at the end of the developmental cycles, which is supposed to happen. Well, I was having all my success when I came back to start throwing again. All my PRs and my seasonal best were happening within the first four sessions of rest or the last four sessions of rest. And I asked about that, and the same was true with Dylan Armstrong. I talked to his coach about that. And the older athletes have their peak form during their rest phases rather than during their developmental phases. So that's something that changes a little bit.
That's interesting.
Because we're old and we need to rest.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, for sure. Hey, I'm getting there, so I'm starting to understand that. Although I'm not really competing competitively anymore, I'm just messing around. But the adaptation curve is so fascinating to me. I was just at a seminar this weekend where they were talking about that. Not even so much from a long term, like a developmental cycle, but just from a single session perspective, you know, and motor learning and skill acquisition, and those types of things. So, I think that's a portion of sports science and coaching that hopefully we'll see a lot more come out, and hopefully that portion of the Bondarchuk system can rub off on some other things, you know, where we can determine who's a fast adapter, who's a slow adapter, and I think a lot of coaches kind of have an idea anyways, but numbers are great.
It's very cool, and I've had the honor, my if it wasn't for Glenn McAtee, my college coach, I wouldn't be where I'm at today. I wouldn't, you know, have the job I have today, and I've had the success in coaching that I've had to this point. And he had the honor, he wanted to come back and start throwing again. He called me up and said, hey, and we talk every day, but he said, hey, could you maybe write the programs for me using Dr. B style? I said, absolutely. So we've gone through about three developmental cycles, and after the first two, I knew exactly where his pattern was at when he came up. And so, like, the third developmental, I was like, I say, all right, coach, the next two or three sessions, you're going to have a big throw. You're going to start coming up. And it's been pinpoint every single time. And that's just his adaptation. And his adaptation is about the same as mine. He's in the 16 to 20 range. So it's very cool to see that. It's very cool to see those things pan out like that every time based on the individual body and how it works.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think even, yeah, those things have implications for any sport, even outside of the Dr. B system or sports where the Dr. B system is probably even something you could do. Just the idea of adaptation patterning and who needs what and who should plan on what particular type before they reach their peak form is fascinating. Well, hey, Nick, I think that's about the end of the time I have for us today.
Hey, we can go forever.
Yeah, I know, right? It's, I mean, just one topic on Bondarchuk's model, I could probably be asking you about 100 questions over the course of at least several hours. So it was great having you on. Thank you for your time today.
My honor, and anytime.
All right, guys, thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, please rate and review on your listening platform of choice. The next week's episode is going to be Jimson Lee of SpeedEndurance.com, where we're going to talk things regarding track, the Olympics, speed training, and more. Stay tuned, and you'll hear from us soon.